and welcome to Written in Uncertainty, an Elder Scrolls podcast sat firmly in the grey maybe of Tamriel, and proud member of the Robots Radio podcast network. My name is Arimithius, and this week we're continuing to look at the Red Guards with a deeper dive into some of the things in their culture that make them unique, namely their gods, how they think about swords, and a brief evaluation of memory stones. But first of all, we've got some network news that I want to talk about. We've had two new shows come up in the Robots Radio Network. We have Keelhauled, which is a Sea of Thieves podcast, and Hidden Blade, which is a podcast on an Assassin's Creed Valhalla. So I'll just leave you now to have a listen to the trailers for those shows.
Ahoy there, ye landlubbers. Avast, my name is Captain Logan, and I'll be your guide out on the Sea of Thieves. If you love the idea of stealing treasure, cutting down cursed skeletons, fighting off krakens, and raiding forts filled to the brim with shinies, then Sea of Thieves is the game for you. Join me each week as I dive into the news and bring back the nuggets of information that any sailor worth their weight in salt would desire. You don't have to be a pirate legend to gain access to my podcast. Just search for Keelhauled, a Sea of Thieves podcast in your podcast app of choice, or head over to robotsradio.net or captainlogan.podbeam.com and get ready to set sail for adventure. Arr.
We also have managed to secure a network-wide sponsorship with Loot Crate. They are a subscription service for various bits and pieces and bits of merchandise for various fandoms. The Elder Scrolls Online is in there. They have Fallout crates. They have various ones connected to the Marvel Universe and a whole bunch of other stuff. So if you want to use their services to get various bits of merchandise, then you can support the network by doing that. You can also get 15% off Loot Crate if you use the referral link that is in this podcast description and use the redemption code ROBOTSRADIO, which is all one word. All the details for that are in the podcast description. And I also just wanted to make a quick announcement and apology for this particular podcast that because of various real life things that are going on, I'm not able to devote quite as much time to researching as I would like at the moment. So this podcast schedule may get a little rocky. They will arrive when they're done. There aren't really enough hours in the day for me to squeeze in my normal level of research and still get everything out on the kind of schedules that I would want, which is a bit of a pain, but I will get there. And because things are being a little fuzzy, then I'm also pausing Patreon for now because I can't guarantee that everything will be up on schedule. So I don't want to commit to say, well, I can give you however much content for however much money. So I don't think it's fair to my patrons for that. So I'm pausing Patreon for now. You will still be able to access all of the notes and stuff. They will still be going on. I will be sending links out for those on Patreon itself and for the Discord as normal. So absolutely feel free to keep those comments coming. And I also want to say thank you to my latest patron, who is Discount Support, who literally joined just as I was starting to think through the consequences of the schedule. So thank you ever so much for wanting to help support the show, Discount Support. And I hope you enjoy looking through the notes and so on that I'll be pulling together in the near future. I also wanted to shout out that another podcast that I'm involved with, the Selective Lorecast, is an actual podcast now. They started in 2014 as a YouTube channel or a YouTube podcast, but we've now actually got stuff together to be an actual podcast on pretty much any podcast you can find at the moment. We're now up to about episode 14. We will be releasing the historical episodes on a weekly basis for that, just so that we can get caught up with everything that's gone on that podcast before now, as well as carrying on with the ongoing bits of that podcast that are happening on Rotten Deadite's Twitch every other week. But at the moment, we're releasing them as weekly episodes just to get the podcast caught up with the show. And now on to the Red Guards. First, I need to make an apology to Albert Gustafsson quickly. The last few podcasts that I've been making on this have made me think that I need to perhaps take a step back and think about what makes things different for the Red Guards and go back to thematic thinking for a while, because jumping whole cloth into the history hasn't really produced structured episodes too much. So I'm going to be going by the themes instead, so charting how they've evolved and what that might mean for the Red Guards, or at least for now, until I can get a fuller sense of their overall history. Before we begin, I just wanted to kick off with my usual disclaimer that this is my own ideas about the Red Guards and how they work, and may well not be the whole truth of the matter. You might have other ideas, and if so, I would absolutely love to hear from you. If I get anything wrong, if you've got anything further to add, please, please, please drop me an email at writtenanduncertaintypodcast@gmail.com, or join the conversation at the Written in Uncertainty Discord server. There's links to all this in the podcast description. And I also want to start with a slight elaboration on some points that I've brought up before now. Red Guards, as mentioned a while back, can be seen as Afrofuturist in a way, but I'm starting to think that might be better seen as a particular extension of the themes of colonialism and the like. So, advance warning on how I talk about this. I am someone with their life set to easy mode. I am a cisgender heterosexual white male, so I'm not as sensitive to these things as I might be, so I'm really sorry if I put my foot in my mouth with any of the stuff that I talk about relating to race and perceptions thereof, because I'm not going to pick up on all the nuances. And so with all that said, the comments on colonialism are because I've looked into it, and the stuff that I said about erasure of history and so on with the Red Guards are still there on various levels. So it's not entirely Afrofuturist. It's, to go back to Michael Kirkbride's quote on the matter, he was talking about the possibilities of black imperialism and making black people the imperial force. The kind of narratives that you can create with that are different to what we've seen black people typecast as frequently within media. So while it's a different take on black people, it might not really be Afrofuturist as such, because there's still that historical erasure that's going on, and we will talk about that a bit more in this episode. And I also want to start with clarifying a question that I've seen crop up in various places and possibly strikes at a bit of what makes Red Guards so different. So I wanted to kick that off right at the get-go. It's the question of whether or not Red Guards are human, or more specifically, because human tends to get applied to any sentient being within the Elder Scrolls, whether Red Guards are men. The argument for this usually goes that as all the other Mannish cultures are in some way descended from At-Mora, then Red Guards should be something else because they come from Yokuda. Where I'm usually inclined to give these things a fair hearing, you'll hear me say quite often that the Bosma may not be elves, for example. I'm just going to stamp on this one right now and say that Red Guards are absolutely men, because unlike the Bosma, there's pretty much nothing I can find that states that Red Guards aren't men. If we take the Anuad as true, which is pretty much the only book to try and fit Yokuda into a unified history of mankind, then the defining characteristic of men is not that they came from At-Mora, but that they are from somewhere other than Tamriel originally. That assertion is its own can of worms, and I've talked about where men come from before on this podcast on a previous episode, but there's nothing even close to suggesting that Red Guards cannot be considered men, even when you look at that sort of thing. And also a quick note on the term human. There is an implication of sentience with the term human. Whatever type of species that person is, they're talked about as human in the Elder Scrolls. You'll have elves talked about as being human in some texts as possibly the best example. I think person is probably the better word, but it's not been used that way. So if someone is called human in the Elder Scrolls, that's a signifier that they're probably worthy of respect and dignity, regardless of what that looks like. There are probably many in Tamriel who consider people like Beastfolk to not be people, to not be humans, but they're just looking for a way to dismiss people they don't like, generally, in the same way as racists in this world tend to. And while the Red Guards are definitely men, from everything that we can tell, they do stand apart from the rest of the Mannish races. According to their tale in the monomyth, Satakar the Worldskin, they think of Mundus as a false world, one that's made out of the dead carcasses of previous worlds. This does have some similarities with the tale told in the Anuad, but otherwise there aren't any other parallels for this within the mythology of the Elder Scrolls. The Mer do consider the world to be a bad place, but that's more to do with the Aedra being tricked into creating the world itself, rather than the world being poorly created, if that makes sense. It's the act of creation that's the issue rather than the method. The Red Guards do seem to have a different spin on it, as the world's not necessarily a bad thing in itself, but a poor imitation of what's come before. It's, to quote, very far from the real world of Satakarl, and so causes things to die. One of the questions that I'm curious about is how the Red Guards would get such a perspective. Some have suggested that they come from a previous Kalpa, another cycle of the world, and so they have an awareness of that cycle and portray it in their own terms, whereas other races don't. I was thinking that this could be invalidated by some books in the Elder Scrolls Online, where Tales of the Famed Explorer and Children of the Root both reference other Kalpas, or at the very least other worlds, in their own terms, having never experienced the transition. But then the Anuad has both the Elnafei and the Hist as survivors of the 12 worlds. With the Argonians returning to the Hist upon death, they have an opportunity to experience something trans-Kalpic. So I think it's possible that something similar is going on here. The Spanner in the Works comes with the unlicensed text Sure Son of Sure, which gives the Nords a similar awareness of the Kalpic cycle. If that's the case, then it feels like we should have all Mannish and Merish races having some kind of acknowledgement of the Kalpic cycle as they come from another of the 12 worlds. The Red Guards seem to stand alone in their thinking differently on that, though. And as a result of that, they also tend to think of things in cycles. The text, Knowing Satakarl, puts this most bluntly with these lines, quote, "To deny that the world must end is to deny that it began. Satakarl is the making and the unmaking, the birth and the death, love and fear. For the world is the egg that Satakarl laid, and the egg that in time Satakarl shall eat. To know Satakarl, consider a river. As a snake sheds its skin and lives on, so a river sheds its water into the sea, yet is reborn at the source. For to be the world skin is to be everything, and to be everything is to be nothing. Fear not the unbelievers, for believer and unbeliever alike shall be eaten by the serpent god. Does not the serpent made of sky above reflect the serpent made of the sea below? Yea, it is so." So Red Guards see things in circles, although Mundus may be something that breaks that cycle. And while there's a possibility of an expectation of cyclicality in Red Guard culture, making your own effort and having your own walkabout is important to get back. Tor Papa sets the stars in the sky so that the spirits could see how to get back to the far shores, but he didn't walk the path for them after all. That's probably another point of similar difference, if I can put it that way, to Tamrielic cultures. The stars, according to most, are the holes torn by the Magna Gae. These holes show a way back to Aetherius in themselves and a way of doing things, a way of achieving some sort of divinity. If we can equate the Far Shores with Aetherius, or a part of Aetherius at least, then the walkabout is a way of transcending Mundus and getting back to the space between worlds where the original spirits came from. Or if we want to tie it up with the Psijic way of thinking, potentially becoming an original spirit. Varieties of Faith explicitly says that the walkabout is, quote, a process by which they can persist beyond one lifetime. It's a path to immortality between worlds. And that is very similar to the Psijic way of thinking, which, according to the old ways, is this, quote, the Daedra and gods to whom the common people turn are no more than the spirits of superior men and women whose power and passion granted them great influence in the afterworld. This is possibly a process similar to the walkabout, or the original walkabout at any rate. There's an indication that at the time of the Interregnum, where ESO is happening, the Red Guards have forgotten about the original purpose of the walkabout and think that it's something for mortals to do as well. To quote Lady Clarice Laurent from a Loremaster's archive, she says this, quote, she told me that the modern tradition of walkabout, a sort of rite of passage for the Red Guard youth, is based on the ancient Red Guard legend of the hero's labours, in which a great warrior of the Dawn era travelled through the Zodiac, facing the challenge at each constellation. That, to me, sounds a bit like some conspiracy theories you'll hear about the pyramids of ancient Egyptians in this world, that the pyramids are, in essence, some sort of cargo cult for ancient alien resurrection technology. It's the premise of Stargate, basically. Because what's happening here is that the rite of passage that Laurent mentions feels like it remembers something of the form of the walkabout, but nothing about how it actually gets people to the Far Shores. So I'm inclined to think that it's just an assumed thing that the Red Guards go to the Far Shores at the moment in their culture, a little like Nords equals Sovngarde, almost regardless of whether they die in battle or not. So quite how right that is another matter altogether. The original walkabout can be linked to some sort of walking way if you squint, but I'm not 100% sure on it. I mean, both involve walking, so you can make the semantic connection. But just to quickly unpack the walking ways for those who might not have heard of them before, they are ways to reach heaven by violence, to quote Vivek. And Z thinks there are six of them. Chim is a walking way, Mantling is a walking way, and there are other less well-defined ones that you'll have some debate in the community about what precisely they are. I'm not sure about which one the walkabout is supposed to be, or even whether mortals can do the proper walkabout, but if it's something that mortals can do, it's either its own thing or some sort of reascension, as with Auriel. So Draco Chrysalis, maybe, but that's far from certain, because as I say, the picture we get of the original walkabout is that it's something to do with the original spirits rather than mortals. There is some suggestion in the lore community that it's something to do with the serpent constellation, or the serpent in general, which would be Lorcan, but from the Red Guard monomyth, Sep wasn't particularly good at helping Torpapa show the spirits to the Far Shores, so while there might be something to the involvement of the serpent, I'm not convinced that the serpent is actually part of the way to do it. One possible argument against the walkabout being a walking way as well is that it was something for the spirits to do rather than the Red Guards themselves, as I said. So if you look at Satakal, the World Skin, in general, the myth does say that Torpapa, quote, told the spirits that they must learn new ways to follow the stars to the Far Shores now, once they're actually on Mundus, rather than the walkabout. So the walking ways, which are inherently mortal, are not really related to the walkabout as far as I'm concerned, probably. Exactly how Red Guard mortals are supposed to get back to the Far Shores isn't really elucidated, but I think it does involve Tuwaka showing them some new way to get to the Far Shores. And that's Tuwaka stepping up and acting as a proper psychopomp, where Sepp didn't really manage that. Exactly what that may be may have something to do with the Red Guard and swords, because swords are everywhere in Red Guard culture. The Emperor's Guide to Tamriel notes this, quote, "Aboard the Sentinel-bound ship, I'm immediately struck by how martial this culture is. From the captain to the rigging boy, all wear their weapons constantly, and the marines who guard this vessel even dressed in heavy armour. What if they fell overboard? Compared to the temperamental Bretons, the Red Guard race seems positively dignified. Standing broad-shouldered and tall, with dark skin and wiry hair, they're seemingly born with a sword in their hand." I just want to clarify here before we get on, just to ease my sense of pedantry, that in this world, historically, sailors didn't necessarily know how to swim. If you were in the water in the old times, in the age of sail and so on, something had gone horribly wrong. So your expectation was that you wouldn't necessarily survive anyway. So the idea of swimming as being part of a historical ship is just nonsense. But anyway, back to the Red Guards and enough of my ranting. It's possible that the author of the guide stepped onto a warship and didn't realize. We don't really know what kind of vessel the author of the Emperor's Guide was on, but we also have another passage further down in that section that gives the sword a much higher place throughout Red Guard society as a whole. Quote, "While the Red Guard soldier carries a variety of other killing implements, which I sketched between bouts of seasickness, a marine named Wazir Al-Main explained that a Red Guard sword is an extension of his soul and a symbol of honour." So, if we take it that way, a sword is an expression of a Red Guard with their personhood and their honour bound up in the sword and how it's applied. In the game, The Elder Scrolls Adventures Red Guard, Cyrus quotes the line like it's in a traditional aphorism that a sword sold is a sword sullied against true cause. That sort of sentiment typically gets applied to other things when talking about the self, or at least the idea of being a sellsword in the sense of being a mercenary. So the notion that the sword and the self are the same thing is connected to the idea of doing something purely for money, and the idea of that doing something for money makes it lesser, which you'll see in a few places today, although there's more emphasis in that than others. Mostly where the self is involved rather than the sword. So you think about how prostitution is traditionally seen. So selling your sword as well as your body, they're both a similar sort of shameful act, is how I'm processing that idea. So I'm registering some identification between the two in that aphorism, and that explanation felt horribly garbled, I'm sorry. But quite how or why the sword has attained that sort of status in Red Guard culture is, I think, to do with their early history. The first thing that we know about the Yokuden men is that they fought against the left-handed elves, and several of their gods were involved with or come from that war. Onsi showed the Yokudens how to make swords, Leki showed them how to use them, and Diagna allowed them to win against the elves by showing them how to make them out of orichalcum. And that would explain why sword singing was a thing in Yokuda. It has a religious and salvatory significance to the Yokudens. It brought them out of this primordial war with the left-handed elves and gave them dominance, allowed them to be themselves. This also has its ultimate expression in the Ansei, the sword saints of Yokuda. And sword singing was the martial art of the Yokudens, and it also includes the idea of the Shihai, the spirit sword that sword singers produce, which is an expression of the self, because only a few Ansei could actually fight with these swords. So I think that the idea of the Shihai as an expression of the self, of being a sword singer, is an even more fundamental part of it than necessarily being able to fight with it. I also want to point out a real-world religious parallel here for a second, which may also explain, or at least give a bit more colour to, the idea of everyone carries a sword, which is presented in The Emperor's Guide. Culturally, and as part of their religious observance, Sikhs are expected to follow the idea of the Sant Sampai, I think that's how you pronounce it, I'm not totally sure, or warrior saint, and they carry the kirpan at all times, which takes the form of a sword. It's not thought of as a sword, but that's what it looks like, and it's supposed to be a constant reminder that Sikhs are there to fight for justice and defend justice. And so it feels like the presence of a sword in modern Red Guard culture might be something like that, that right down to the rigging boy carrying a sword is as much a marker of I am a Red Guard as it is I'm ready to fight. I say that that's part of modern Red Guard history because, as we talked about in the episode on the Yokudans, the idea that non-sword singers would wear a sword is very unusual. It was a subject of political contention in Yokuda. And if you want to hear more about that, go back to my episode on the Yokudans, where I talk through that. And the way that the Red Guards treat swords and the way the Yokudans treat swords feels a little different, because there was a very deliberate period of non-sword use, from what I can tell, or at least a conscious choice to put sword singing in their past when they arrived on Tamriel. Sword singing, as a result, is pretty much a lost art in Tamriel, although there's some, like Sysahan, who have tried to bring it back. There's also part of me that thinks that it will come back in The Elder Scrolls 6, but that's some way off, and that's purely just me thinking, what kind of a game mechanic like Thum can they do? And sword singing seems like a convenient shoehorn in there. Going back to the Red Guard's general attitude to swords, I think there was a conscious choice to put sword singing as such behind them. The sword singers were consistently singled out for their practices in Yokuda, which Frandor Hunding and his followers may not have wanted to repeat. There's also this line from the book The True Told Tale of Halen, quote, "Know then, O prince, that after the Regarda had swept across Hammerfell, driving all the Tusk folk before it, a time of peace befell, whereupon the people who were once Yokudans were able to lay down the sword and take up the shovel and trowel. And for three spans of a person's life, all the Red Guards did delve and build, and many were the great works that were erected above the sands. And few did study the way of the sword, for all were constructing monuments to the greatness of our people." So that time of peace, assuming that the span of a person's life means a lifetime, is long enough for sword singing to pretty much disappear, because the Red Guards had no real need of it. However, there was a continued reverence for the trappings of sword singing, if I can put it that way, and swords in general. The value that's placed on the Book of Circles as a thing to keep in your homes and recite and all that all point to the idea of valuing the concept of the sword and what the sword means, but not having an actual presence of swords and martial life. Although there is possibly a reason within Red Guard culture that you'd have thought they'd be able to preserve it better than pretty much anyone else. You'll hear the Red Guards associated with memory stones, which are used to record the particular thoughts of the individual. And the way that they're talked about in communities is a little confusing. They are treasured relics of the Red Guard's past, and so you'd imagine that they came from Yokuda, but they didn't. And they're also rare, even at the time of The Elder Scrolls Online, so how to be a sword singer isn't particularly well recorded. There's this little nugget in Red Guards, their history and their heroes, that puts the lie to what you'll generally hear about Red Guards and memory stones. Quote, "The memory stone mentioned in the second chapter may not be familiar to all readers. It is a stone whose mineral content makes it only found in the far north of High Rock, and there are a few of them to begin with. At one time, there was a mage that lived in the vastness and wastes of that region, and he, in practicing enchantment spells, imbued several hundreds of them with the ability to hold and record one's thoughts. So, memory stones coming from higher rock means that the Red Guards will only have had them since coming to Tamriel. They were not something that came from Yokuda, and they were also part of a one-off creation event, and so there will only be a handful of accounts of Red Guard culture at all on these things, so getting a picture of their old culture is quite unlikely. That means that the way that the Red Guards think about their culture now is likely to be a reconstruction based on modern feelings and a kind of cultural nostalgia rather than the reality of what came before. And I think that the use of the sword and the way that the Crowns and the Forebears treat each other are both very definite testaments to that. And we will get to the Crowns and the Forebears next time. We will be delving into the more recent history of the Red Guards and going over their relations with the rest of Tamriel, how they fitted in, and that sort of thing. Pretty much from the foundation of the Crowns and the Forebears, using that as the lens to look at everything. So I do hope you can join me for that. And please let me know if you have any questions on that. You can always contact me by email at writteninuncertaintypodcast@gmail.com or tweet me at Aramithius if you have any questions. And until next time, this podcast remains a letter written in uncertainty. You've been listening to Written in Uncertainty, a podcast written and presented by Aramithius. The music for this podcast has been kindly provided by Jan Glembotsky. Check them out on SoundCloud under Songs from the Lost Land, and I'll see you next time.
Myth is a podcast about the very soul of humanity. Join me each week as I explore stories from our history, from our mythologies, about what it means to be human. I'm your host, Tom, and Myth is available on every podcatcher, anywhere. And if you're familiar with any of my other work, then you might realize that Myth is like a lore cast, but for humans. Join me each week on Myth.
Are you worried you don't have all the answers?
Have you ever found yourself in an internet rabbit hole?
Call Mystery Time Live today!
It's a new detective business.
With plenty of heart.
And a questionable track record.
We're only in the office for an hour.
Every Wednesday.
Come hang out.
Solve a mystery.
It's a podcast.
It's a live show.
It's a swell time.
Subscribe now!
The producers of Mystery Time Live ask you kindly not to take any advice or guidance from the host because they have no idea what they're doing. No mystery will ever be fully solved unless individualized from any outside source or sheer luck. You can find them live on the Twitch app and find their podcast later on YouTube, Anchor, Spotify, Google, and iTunes. Listening may cause hurtful your death or loss of sanity. We are sorry. This is probably legally binding and you cannot sue us.
Hey, I'm Tom.
And I'm Stuart.
And we're from the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast.
We talk about all things connected to D&D lore.
And we're on the Robots Radio Network. So if you're into Dungeons & Dragons or you're into lore, then come check us out. You can find us on any podcatcher, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you get podcasts.
Roll more dice.
That's the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast.